You are listening to From Sobriety to Recovery with Jesse Mogul. Let's get to the show. Welcome back to From Sobriety to Recovery. I am your host, Jesse Mogul. I am in addiction recovery. I've missed y'all. It has been 2 weeks since I've posted a show, and as one of the members of the tribe pointed out on Voxer the other day, that I only miss an episode when something is really going on in my life, and we are looking at back-to-back mouth surgeries on the 5th and the 12th. So currently, it feels like someone pulled my mouth out through my cheek then forced it back in through the other side of my mouth. And so we're doing this in slight a bit of pain, but I know that the more I wait after the surgery, the worse the pain gets. Day 3 and 4 are pretty excruciating to the point where I'm just like, rip out my teeth. I will just go George Washington wood dentures on this. So there's a lot to talk about. A lot of stuff has been rattling through my mind. And what we're going to cover today are rules, spoken and unspoken, conscious and unconscious rules that are governing our lives and how these can either be benefiting us or no longer serving our highest sense of self. And what we're seeking in our addiction recovery is that adaptation toward moving up the evolutionary ladder of our own selves, right? And rather than spiraling down, we are seeking to evolve upwards and be able to adapt to this new way of life that is going to seem foreign to some of us, if not all of us, because of how long we spent in our active addiction. So we're going to be covering roles today and a little bit of rules, but a lot of roles and rules and rules and roles. And maybe in the end, they all just sort of meld together. And this really has been coming together as an episode for the last couple weeks. I started a book by Robert Sapolsky called Behave, and it talks about humans at our best and worst and the biology of it. And then I'm watching this show on Apple Plus. And last night, one of the characters starts talking about, this is set off way in the future, and he starts talking about how we may have all come from this planet called Earth. I mean, it's that far off in the future that humans don't even know where they came from anymore. And there can be some of y'all out there who may not even believe that we really came from Earth first, but we'll get into that in a different show and a different episode. But what this man said that really struck me and caused me to rewind the scene and listen to it again is he started talking about the brain and how we as humans experience everything emotionally first and then rationally and then with our thinking mind. And this is why I call my company Wise Mind Empowerment, and this is why I focus on the wise mind. It is the melding of the emotional mind and the rational mind so that we can operate from a wise mind where we're not completely unemotional, but we're not so completely rational that we can't touch into the emotions, and we're not so emotional that we don't know how to step into the rational. It's very important that we're balancing the two. And as I'm continuing to listen to the Behave book and I'm thinking about what this person said, some really cool stuff came out in the Behave book. And the guy started talking about all the different systems that are operating within us at any given moment for us to achieve anything. And while I didn't put it to memory, I'm certainly going to rattle off some of the parts that stuck out. But he's like, you know, just sitting here right now, I'm moving my hands, I'm talking to you, I'm fiddling with this deck of cards. You know, a behaviorist might say that this behavior, you know, was adapted from, you know, years of fiddling with things as a child. And maybe I saw my parents fiddling with things, or maybe I didn't see my parents fiddling with anything, and I needed something active to do with my hands in order to calm my mind. A behaviorist would say that our behaviors are adapted from our environment, from society, from our family, from people around us. A biologist would say, well, the reason that I am now playing with this cards is because my biology, there are, you know, blood's pumping through my muscles and my fingers, and it's allowing me to move these cards up and down into one another because synapses and things of like that are moving within the brain, causing this entire biological movement that allows my hands to shuffle. Whereas somebody who's more into anatomy might want to focus in on the muscles and the fingers and how I'm sitting in this seat and all my muscles are activated in my ankles and in my hips to keep me balanced. And, you know, someone like me who is more prone to want to understand the brain and the way that we have developed ourselves would use a little bit of that behaviorist and also would want to know the whys. Why is it that I am sitting here playing with these cards? And why is it that I'm sitting here talking to you on the show? And where is all of this stemming from? And so whether we're focused on the anatomy or the biology or the mind or the behaviorisms, and these are just four, the guy literally rattles off through another five or six of these things, where different people in different fields of science, psychology, biology, anatomy, all that jazz, would all have a different reason for why we are doing something. In the book, he references that little old riddle, why did the chicken cross the road? And, you know, it could have been because it saw a attractive chicken across the road. It could have been because it was hungry and it was led by its belly, or it was led by its hormones, or it was led because, you know, it had knees that were allowed to be fired by the brain that allowed it to move. And it uses that chicken as this example for all the different systems that are going on at any given time that allow us to achieve what it is we do in our lives, whether that's just the breathing that's done at an unconscious level, unless we bring it conscious, all the way to the digestion and the blood flow and the thinking. I mean, so much of our lives is done through a trance-like state where we are really not in control of as much as we think we are. And it's blessed that our minds and our brains and our body and all that jazz is working in concert with one another, because if we had to spend all of our time thinking about breathing and digesting and taking steps forward, we wouldn't have time to have evolved to be this species that now has supercomputers in their pockets. I mean, think about even the cave people. If they had to focus all their attention on breathing, then there would have been no space left for them to go out and hunt. And they would have just been in the cave being like, oh, if I'm not thinking about breathing, then I stop breathing. Right? We need so much of our lives to be on autopilot. What ends up happening, though, is that we find a majority of our life being on autopilot when certain things actually need to be a lot more conscious. We need to be more self-aware of them. And what we're going to do when we discuss rules and roles today is we're going to be bringing in a little bit of what I've been learning in my Masters of Psychology Theories class that I'm currently taking. Because where this started to spark was whenever I came across a chapter by Virginia Satir. Now, Virginia Satir was extremely good at her job. She was a psychologist, she was a therapist, and she was really honing her craft back in the 70s and 80s, where she was very focused on helping family dynamics and figuring out why families weren't working well within one another. What was wrong with their familial system? What was needing to be adapted within the structure that would allow them to be more cohesive and get along? What we're learning is the more and more that we really get into the psychology of addiction, not just on this show, but in society in general, is that if one person in the family is sick, everybody in the family is sick. And what this means whenever we say that is that whether it's addiction or whether it's cancer, if there's somebody in the family that's going through something of that nature, then everybody starts to adapt in order to find a homeostasis around them. Now, if it's addiction, then obviously the adaptations are going to be, you know, similar but a lot different than if it's somebody with cancer. But if somebody has cancer, you know, somebody has a major illness in your family, then people start to adapt their behaviors about what they might talk about, the way they might expose that person to certain conversations, or the way that they walk around them, the way they may have to help them. A lot of things will change. And it's because of this that over prolonged periods of time, people in your family may have changed their behaviors in ways they didn't really want to, but were best suited to working toward what it was that you were going through. So if addiction was very much running your life, then there may have been a lot of their behaviors that changed in order to either placate and enable or to not be codependent. And so when we start to dive into these rules, these roles that we've taken on within ourselves, within the family, within the society, we realize that a lot of these are unspoken. That these were changes that began to happen and shift that have changed our entire trajectory of our lives. Someone in the tribe today posted this really cool meme that said, I have fallen into a pattern and mistaken it for my identity. I will now step outside of it. And it's just a really good reminder that patterns we might mistaken for our identity, but they are not our identity if we decide to pull them out of the shade, out of the shadows, put them into the light and decide, is this actually serving my best sense of self? Is this what matters the most to me? Is this going to lead me where I want to go? Another of the memes that was posted in the tribe today was, first it's an intention, then a behavior, then a habit, then a practice, then it's second nature, then it's simply who we are. What ends up happening a lot within these rules and roles that we take on within ourselves, within our family, within society, is that some will be intentional and others will not be. But then it becomes the behavior, a habit, a regularly practiced behavior and habit, then second nature, then it's simply who we are. And if you want to start locating where these rules are showing up in your life, just notice if you've ever said something to the effect of, well, that's not how my family does it. That's not something that we talk about. That's not something that we do. This is something we always do. This is something we absolutely talk about, right? It's very interesting where that can be beneficial and it can be, I don't know if hurtful is the right word, but it could definitely not be serving. This can happen a lot when we look back at the way children were raised in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, up until really the internet, when all of a sudden everything just sort of exploded because we had so much information available to us. But I definitely remember being told, you know, we don't talk about sex in our family. We don't talk about money at the dinner table. We don't talk about emotions. You know, don't say that in front of dad. He's had a long day. Don't say that in front of mom. She's not feeling well today. We don't discuss this. We don't discuss that. There was a lot of things that we didn't do that were very strategically decided upon. At least when I wanted to bring them up, they were definitely shut down. And you may have come from a family where talking about sex or money or emotions was very open. That itself is also a rule. So let's discuss rules in even more in-depth ways that I want you to be able to start noticing them in your life, because they play a very crucial role in shaping your behavior, your interactions at various levels of the human experience, right? Again, within yourself, within the family, within society at large. And each of these contexts utilizes rules in a very unique way to maintain order, to ensure safety, to promote growth. And I want you to understand how rules function across all of these levels. Then there's an appreciation for their significance in the psychological, in the social dynamics that we are literally living in every single day. So how will these rules show up within you as an individual? They can show up as self-regulation, decision-making, identity formation, and your cognitive and emotional development, right? It's that opportunity for us to have structure as children, providing a framework for understanding very complex social cues, processing emotions in socially acceptable ways. Now, we're going to get into the pros and cons of this a little bit later, but when we start to say socially acceptable ways, imagine somebody weeping in public. Generally, people are not comfortable with emotions, so then when they see that, they might say something derogatory or walk away. And it really has less to do with the person weeping and so much more to do with people around them having the ability to process what's going on. When we start talking about identity formation, certain rules, rejecting others, it will define your relation within your culture, your community, your personal beliefs. Religion plays a very strong influence on the way that rules will play a role in your life. Within the family, role definitions, right? The parent, the child, the sibling. Are you the first, the second, the third child? What side comments are made about that? Oh, the first child always works harder. The third child's always more flippant, right? Now that becomes an identity level statement if it's said to the children all throughout their growing up. When I've actually just recently read an empirically researched article that was published that I had to read for my master's class that states that when studies are done over a long period of time, the patterns that we think are established by being the first, second, third, and so on child doesn't actually hold true. The pattern doesn't actually exist in the way that the family perceives it. They might perceive the first child to be more hardworking versus the third child who's a little bit more laissez-faire. But that actually doesn't prove true whenever it's studied from an outside perspective, where people are not trying to confirm a bias, where they're actually trying to see the truth, versus the first child who might actually rebel against the rules that were forced upon them, versus the third child who was not being held to the same level of accountability as the first child. And I think that for any of you who have that kind of family dynamics, you'll know that generally the first child gets ruled with a much heavier hand than the third child does. So role definitions within the family, communication patterns. Do we talk about things? Do we not talk about things? How do we express our emotions? How do we resolve conflicts? Boundaries between family members and the outside world. Oh, we'll talk about that at the dinner table with us, but we don't talk about our private matters in the public forum. I definitely remember that being a boundary that was laid down for me. We do not discuss private matters. If it happens in this house, unless you're given permission to take it outside of this house, we do not discuss it with people outside of this home. And then there's cultural and moral values transmissions that can come within the family. Right, your morals, your ethics, your values, your opinions, your beliefs, right? These are going to be manipulated and influenced by the rules that your family begins to lay down at a very young age. We do this to transmit cultural norms, moral values to the younger generations, right? This is where you want your children to look both ways before crossing, or to say please and thank you and be polite in public and not talk too loud at a table at a restaurant, not scream and yell and run around the restaurant like a wild ubangi, which you may do at home, but you're not doing it, at a chain restaurant. There wants to be that cohesion amongst the family when they begin to think about how they want to act in a public forum. And then within society, rules that can show themselves would be social order and cohesion. We've got laws, we've got mandates, we've got things that we want to do within society that keep us from just, sliding back down into barbarian kind of age. It's very interesting how laws and that fear of punishment will cause people who don't have nearly as much to lose as someone else to still not act in a negative way, to not break into a home, to not mug you on the streets, to not just punch you in the face for no reason, right? We're looking for regulatory behaviors within the public spaces, ensuring fair transactions, protecting individual rights. Rules within society help keep order and cohesion. They also will build cultural identity. We can all understand cultural identity in a much grander scheme when we think of countries, France or Germany, United States, Zimbabwe, Nigeria, Belize, Chile, Peru, China, India, Kazakhstan. When we think about these places, there's a cultural identity that, whether it's true or not, whether it's based off of a bias or a stereotype, when I say any of those countries, there's still something that pops into your mind. If I say Canada, a very different picture of Canada is going to pop in your mind than would pop into your mind for Mexico. There's going to be a different ways that we're going to internalize those. That's cultural identity. How do we distinguish one society from another? Socialization is another way that individuals learn the rules of society. It starts at a young age in school where we're taught, sit down, raise your hand, don't interrupt people, right? Those golden rules that we learned in kindergarten that for some reason just don't seem to be as prevalent in today's society. But we're looking to keep that social fabric woven together. How are we going to interact appropriately, cooperatively, together, within various contexts of our society? And then, of course, conflict resolution, which I think shows up in all three of these. How do we resolve conflicts? In society, it would be through the court system, judicial, right? There's contracts, there's agreements that are made, legal system, resolving disputes and conflicts. Within the family, the parents might be the judge, jury, and executioner, and everybody sits down and has a conversation to figure out who's at fault and who needs to be punished. Now, who is going to place the parents, into that same system? The kids? I mean, who gets to be judge, jury, and executioner if it's the mom or the dad that's going off and acting all willy-nilly and coming home and bringing in the chaos? And then, of course, we're also going to have our own conflict resolutions within ourselves. How do we resolve conflicts with ourselves internally on how we might communicate with someone, how we might forgive someone, how we might love someone, right? I know love may not seem necessarily like a conflict, but if you've been hurt in the past, loving someone else in the future might be a very strong conflict. And how are you going to resolve that? See, these rules at each level, the individual, the family, the society, they interact, they influence one another. So, for instance, societal norms may shape your family practices, your family behaviors, which in turn will influence the rules that you internalize individually. Conversely, these changes in an individual, whether it's your attitudes or behaviors, can lead to massive shifts in family dynamics, and then eventually societal norms. And you think about the way that somebody may have gotten very accustomed to interacting with you when you were intoxicated, when you were in your active addiction, and now you're no longer actively addicted. Now that's something that you're seeking through sobriety and recovery to shift and change. And now you've changed your own individual attitudes and behaviors, which will inevitably lead to family dynamic shifting, or at least you hope. Because if everybody keeps treating you like they always treated you, you might feel the urge of, well, why am I even bothering if nobody's even freaking paying attention? So we want to be very mindful of that as well. See, the understanding of the interplay of these is crucial within the psychology of how we determine we are going to begin to interact with the world around us. Whether it's social psychology, developmental psychology, family therapy that Virginia Satir, whom I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, focused on, when we examine these functions and the impact of these rules across these levels, now we can begin to address our individual, our collective psychological needs. We can facilitate a healthier, happier us. We can facilitate a healthier, happy family dynamic. And obviously, this is going to play a role in the way that we begin to shift society. The way society treated school in 1883 is not the same way that it treats school in 2024. Back in the day, if you got a third, fourth, fifth grade education, you know, that was it. I mean, all you needed to know was how to read, how to write, and then it was off to the farm with you. When we got into the factory system, once the Industrial Revolution rolled around, still, school's not as important whenever you need everybody working in order to bring money because we got to eat, and you're really just going to be doing the same activity over and over and over and over and over again. Now we've moved in more to a gig economy where it's more service oriented. Now school matters because we're looking for new ways to interact with one another, new societal norms. These supercomputers in our pockets and in the vast array of information that can be presented to us. I mean, somewhere along the lines, the statistic came into my head that since like 2013, humans have created more information than had ever been created up to 2013. That we in a day will come across more information, more stimuli than people in the 1700s and 1800s would have come across in their entire lives. So we are in the active mode of shifting these rules and these roles. But we're doing so at a breakneck speed, where our brains are not prepared for this level of evolution this fast. Now, we can choose to shift our mindset and say, I will take on as much of this as I possibly can, but there still needs to be a bit of levity that we provide ourselves in knowing that we're not going to have it all figured out. In the neuro-linguistic programming course that I'm teaching with Aubrey Pohl, it's coming up. If you are interested in learning neuro-linguistic programming from me and Aubrey Pohl, I would highly recommend you go over to jessemogul.com/askme, click on the NLP course, fill out the form. I will get you on a phone call. We'll discuss how this can help you in your sobriety and recovery because it changed everything about my life. So if you're interested in that, jessemogul.com/askme, click on the little link. It'll open up a Google form, fill it out. I will get out to you within a day or two. Now, back to what I was talking about. In the very introductory day of our NLP class, we talk about how our brain has 2.3 million bits of data flying at it every single second, and only 126 of them are able to be grasped by the conscious mind, meaning that basically 2.3 million bits of data every single second are going straight into the unconscious mind where they're being held, housed, foldered, organized in whatever way our deletions, our distortions, and our generalizations deem it so. And then there's all these other filters too: time, space, mood, attitude, experiences, memories, metaprograms, personality traits. There's so much of these systems. And as I discussed at the beginning of the show, whether you're a biologist, an anatomist, a behaviorist, a psychologist, however you want to frame the way that a human will experience this world and how they go about doing things in this world, they're all accurate. They're all happening at the same time. None of them get to exist within their own bubble. We might not pay attention to how our anatomy or our anatomy is working in order to shuffle these cards right now as I talk on this microphone, but it's happening nonetheless. So now these rules become this double-edged sword. While they can foster order, safety, and growth, they can also lead to restriction, conflict, dysfunction when they're poorly designed or implemented. And if you go back to what I just said about 2.3 million bits of data every single second, and you're only able to consciously hold 126 of those bits in your conscious mind, in that sort of short-term memory that people talk about, and how limited it is, it is the desktop of your computer. It is the one program that's open, but the hard drive is where everything is stored. And if it's disorganized, then it's going to be very difficult for you to figure out what rule might be commanding this particular behavior in the moment. And when we are unable to find out where the rules are located, then it can be a little bit more difficult for us to shift it. Now, it's pretty obvious if I say something like, well, my family, we didn't talk about sex. We didn't talk about emotions. We didn't talk about money. Well, then that's pretty easy to find the rule. My family didn't do that. Well, does you want your family to do that now? Because I don't really care too much about how my parents decided to raise me. I now want to run my own family, and I want to do it in a much different way in some regards than the way that they did it. While some of those rules served them, they came from a different time in societal norms and familial growth. I want my partner and I to be able to talk about money and emotions and sex. I want us to be able to have those conversations because I saw how not having those conversations affected my parents, right? How many of us are children of divorce? How many of us might not be children of divorce, but then we see our parents or our grandparents at a very old age really not that into each other, spiting each other, in fact. It's because these rules existed that caused a lack of conversation that then no one was able to break free from, to ultimately have the conversations that would have led them to a more amazing, beneficial relationship. And if you have these kind of rules with your siblings, with your parents, with your grandparents, with your friends, right, but there's that internal desire to not have the rule, to have that conversation, then you're going to want to figure out a way to break through that role, break through that rule. Break through all of it. It's just extremely interesting how many of these rules and roles no longer serve us, but yet we hold so steadfast to them. Again, because we took on a pattern of behavior as being who we are. Your patterns of behavior do not have to be your identity. We've allowed them to be because we've decided that it's just easier to trance through life than it is to actually be self-aware. Like Matthew McConaughey says in that one commercial about AI, who's going to become self-aware first, us or computers? And I know I've referenced that before, but when he said that, it was just so poignant because we're nowhere near as self-aware about ourselves as we think we are. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that 2.3 million bits of data are flying at our faces at all times. Like, seriously, that's a lot of information for the brain. So I'm not asking for us to be able to grasp all 2.3 million bits. The possibility of that is it just doesn't exist. But I would for us to like to be more intentional about the 126 bits that we do decide to grasp a hold of. So let's rattle off through some good and some bad. And I know I've been sort of kind of aiming for these episodes to be shorter since the new year started, but I haven't talked to you guys in like 2 weeks and I miss you. So this is going to go a little bit longer. One of my tribe members likes to point out that I like to say, I'll get you out of here on this, and then I talk for 20 minutes. So I'm not going to say that yet. I'm going to try to keep that to actually when I plan on getting you out of here. So let's talk about some examples of how rules can manifest in positive and negative ways within yourself, within the family, and within the societal context. Seeing these, knowing where they're at, is going to be extremely beneficial. So within your own individual self, positive ways, good ways, beneficial, desirable ways that these rules can show up. Self-discipline, a ability to notice how you are disciplining yourself. Are you getting up and going to the gym? Are you eating healthy? Are you allowing yourself to be less restrictive and enjoy some sugar once in a while? What is your self-discipline rules? What about your health maintenance, your self-care? Do you exercise? Do you eat healthy? Your emotional regulation? Are you adhering to practices of mindfulness or emotional or spiritual growth so that you can bring a level of stability to yourself? Your rules around goal achievements, whether it be financial, whether it be sobriety and recovery based, whether it be within your relationships, what kind of rules do you have around your goal achievements? Personal Grohl. I don't know why I just said David Grohl's last name. By the way, Foo Fighters, excellent band. Personal growth, not Grohl. Do you have a rule where you try to read every single day or learn something new and then implement into your life? What about positive habits? Do you want to wake up early each day? Do you want to cultivate a new level of productivity or better time management into your life now that you're getting your wings about you within sobriety and recovery? What about your ethical behaviors? What rules do you have around honesty and trust and integrity? I just recently created a really cool ebook about my triumvirate of sobriety and recovery, and it is all based off of being humble and grateful and having its integrity. And if you remember me talking about my first therapist, Melissa over at Kaiser, she taught me that sobriety is built upon the pillars of being of humility, integrity, and gratitude. And so I created an entire ebook for that, and it'll be coming up soon over on my Stand store. And you can find the link for that over in my show notes. And then I'm building whole web pages for these episodes of these podcasts. And I've already got, I think, about 7 or 8 done over at jessemogul.com/from sobriety to recovery, where I'm going to start building pages out for all these podcasts. And you're going to be able to locate the link to the Stand store there so that you can get that ebook I made. It's amazing. I've only let one person read it, and they were very, very intrigued by the information that was in there. So your ethical behaviors around your honesty, your humility, your gratitude, your integrity, your trust. Unbeneficial ways that rules can show up in your life. Over-restriction. Are you too rigid on yourself? Whether it could be your nutrition strategy and how you eat, or your time management, or the way that you interact with your friends, or how much free time you give yourself. Over restriction, and what kind of rules do you have around that? Isolation, perfectionism, avoidances of asking for help, risk aversion, negative self-talk, dependency. Right. This is where rules around, especially as perfectionism one. Let's highlight this for a moment. If you demand perfection of yourself for every task, it's going to bring anxiety and it's going to become burnout. In my life, I have had to interview for jobs, and I've been the interviewer for jobs. And at a very young age in my whole adaptation from childhood to adolescence to adulthood, I learned during these interviews that whenever somebody asks, what do you say is a good quality about yourself, or what would be a bad quality about yourself, either or, do not be bringing up perfectionism, because perfectionism is a bad quality. It is not a good quality. And there are plenty of studies and books that will state that this idea of seeking perfection in everything will actually cause you to buffer your growth. It'll hold you back. If you're afraid of turning in the essay before you think it's perfect, then you might spend an inordinate amount of hours tiddling around with it whenever that's actually not going to improve your grade. But it's more of an anxiety that it won't be good and get you a bad grade. There's this 80-20 rule that 80% of the awesome that you create in your life comes from 20% of the effort. I have realized in my master's school that once I've read it over 3 times, I do have a way of reading it over. I read it over first in Grammarly, then I put it into the software, I read it again, and then I'll walk away from it for a few hours and I'll read it backwards from the very bottom of the essay back up, just looking for any kind of confusion or grammatical errors that I didn't catch the first time. Once I have done that, and those little editing things I just mentioned up, that will not take very long. Just takes long enough, and then that's it. Send it off. And if I missed a period or a comma, then you know what? That's what just the way that the cookie crumbles. Be aware of perfectionism and where it might be showing up. Risk aversion. For those of us who are, long-term addicts, we actually may have been more risk prone because we get intoxicated, and then it would be like throwing ourselves, onto the top of a car and letting our friends speed down the road, or, doing lots of drinking and then pouring ourselves into our car and driving home intoxicated. Now you get sober and you might be averse to risk, where you're too cautious, meaning that you don't step out for new experiences. You don't learn and grow and seek out new opportunities. So be mindful of within yourself the good of the self-discipline, the health maintenance, the emotional regulation, the goal achievement, the personal growth, the positive habits, the ethical behaviors. These are desirable ways rules show up in your life. Less desirable ways will be over-restriction, isolation, perfectionism, avoidance of asking for help. Come on, guys. We all know when we go to meetings and we surround ourselves by other people who have similar stories, who have gone through some of the traumas we have, we feel better from it. Risk aversion, negative self-talk, dependency, undesirable ways right there. Now, within the family, desirable ways that rules can show up is where we have supportive communication. We have respect for our individuality. We have an adaptability and a flexibility that promotes resilience. We share responsibilities. Distribution of chores that are fair and cooperative. We spend quality time with one another, that stuff matters. We put the phones down. We turn the TV off. We pay attention to one another and have really constructive conversations. In my family, watching TV for an hour a night is quality time for us. We've had the dinner. We've talked about things. And then afterwards, we'll watch 1 hour of television together. And then I'm back in my office and, girlfriend goes and reads a book or does what she's going to do around the house. And stepson goes off and does what he's going to do. But for that 1 hour, we sit there and we watch a show together. And it's fun to talk about and experience it with one another. But we don't inundate ourselves with TV, nor do we try to completely block it away either. Watching shows is a fun way for us to be able to bond because we get to, just experience these cool shows and talk about the plot and the characters and all of that. Good ways that these rules will show up will be in conflict resolution, constructive ways that we resolve disputes, preventing from them from becoming resentments. Resentments, little tiny resentments, become blown up into rejections if left long enough. And so when we don't feel like talking about something, then all of a sudden we've got these little things that begin to stack up. And that's when we find ourselves yelling at one another, is whenever we've allowed these little tiny resentments about putting a spoon in the sink or not starting the coffee maker or making the bed or whatever it might be. Right, these little tiny resentments can add up, and next thing you know, you're yelling and screaming about something, and it's like, okay, this emotional thing happening right now seems way overblown for what we're actually talking about. That's because these little resentments have been building up, and then they finally stack up, and like a volcano, they explode into a rejection moment, which is when you begin to argue. And then a positive way that rules can show up in the family would be cultural heritage. Certain holidays that are practiced, family identity, cohesion that comes through celebrating, the 16th birthday, the quinceañeras, or, it could be, Easter, St. Patrick's Day, 4th of July, Halloween, like these cultural heritages, these things that we create as traditions are rules that we follow that can be very beneficial. Undesirable or bad ways that we could notice these rules showing up within the family. Authoritative parenting, rigid, punitive rules that can lead to fear and mistrust. This helicopter, tiger mom kind of parenting thing that we've got going on right now. My theory on it is it is a hard, sharp curve from the latchkey kids that we were in the 80s and 90s. Now we've got this authoritative parenting that's hovering because a lot of the children from my generation who were raised as latchkey kids wanted their parents in their life more. Well, now we've auto-corrected ourselves too sharply the other way. And now we're not allowing our kids enough freedom to fall on their face, to, make a mess in the kitchen and have to learn how to clean it up, or to burn something that they've cooked, or to not just do something right the first 20 times. Like, we had to learn everything without parents around us. it was like a note, hey, put this in the oven at 400 degrees and, you know, make sure you cut up the salad, right? It's like, okay, I've watched mom do that. There's no internet to teach me how to do it. I've just got to figure it out or call up someone who can answer the phone and have them talk me through it on the other end. But still, there's no one holding my hand as I do it. Another, a couple other bad ways that rules can show up in the family would be a lack of privacy or personal space. Inflexibility, which would be the opposite of that adaptability we talked on the good, desirable side, or where we're too stringent, we're too strict. Overprotection, unrealistic expectations. Well, your brother did it, why can't you? I did this when I was a kid, why can't you? I had to, you know, do this as a child. I had to do a lot of things as a child that I would not want other children to have to experience. I love my mom to death, from here to the moon, you know, to Andromeda and back. And at the same time, you know, I'm glad I could be there to help her clean up the shitty sheets whenever her ostomy bag broke and be there to support her in that way. But I wouldn't want other kids to have to experience that with their own mothers. Yes, I had to grow up very fast as a child, but it is not necessarily, I mean, it is what it is. It was a good, bad, right, wrong. I mean, you know, at this point, I'm indifferent. It was just my childhood. At the same time, I don't want to have unrealistic expectations on the children of today or other people being like, well, I had to deal with so much when I was younger. Why can't you figure it out now? That's an unrealistic expectation that completely negates what potential life experiences or trauma or, you know, just life manifestations that may have happened to them. My way was not the best or right way. It was just the way that I was raised, that I grew up, the things that I did. I've got somebody right now who's in the tribe and also a client who's getting sober at 23. It boggles my freaking mind because at 23, I was not thinking about getting sober, right? So if I were to put unrealistic expectations, I might say something to the effect of, ah, man, you got plenty of time. Just go back and do what you were doing. You'll be fine. You can clean it all up at 40, right? Just expect that you'll eventually figure it out. No, he wants to figure it out now. His expectations are that he can figure it out now. They're not unrealistic because they're driven by his own internal desires. So how might you be placing unrealistic expectations on someone? You might say, well, because you've seen me be an addict for 20 years, you shouldn't do it. Well, that's an unrealistic expectation that you could place on somebody in your life, because clearly we have seen that regardless if parents are alcoholics, it is still very possible for the child to grow up thinking that is a very suitable behavior. Gender biases, rules that enforce stereotypes that can promote inequality and limit someone's potential. We see this happening not just in the family, but within society as we start to grow out our STEM, what is that, like science, technology, education, medicine, right? Where for the longest time, those were believed to just be man roles. And whether you are thrilled about the fact that we existed for, you know, hundreds and thousands of years with very defined roles for a man or a woman, it's only been since World War II, since we've been able to have technology all of a sudden wash our clothes and cook our food and do so much for us, that we've now been able to step away from really just taking care of our home and feeding ourselves. Now we don't have to worry about growing our own food. We don't have to worry about the source of our water. There's so much more time we have now that is allowing us to break through these gender biases that were beneficial at some point in society's time, or they wouldn't have been, they would no longer have been continued to be followed. The human experience dictates that we do things because they're beneficial, not because they're not beneficial. If they're not beneficial, we stop doing them. Someone in 2024 may not be able to look back and understand why somebody in 1317 wanted to stay home and cook all the meals and have all the children and take care of the home, but they don't also understand what was going on in that time period, right? That there was you know, random acts of violence, and there was wars and barbarianism, and there was just things that our gender biases were formed over the course of, you know, millennia, and now we're able to break through them because our technological advancements have allowed us to really free up a majority of our time that, you know, a couple hundred years ago would have been unfathomable for species like ours to be able to think that we could just go work somewhere, make some money, and then go buy some food. Back in the day, everybody was making their own food. Or they were, you know, making horseshoes because they were the blacksmith and then trading that for food. But they were doing something, right? So we want to notice where, in a bad way, gender biases or emotional suppression rules against expressing emotional vulnerability, where it's okay for young girls to cry, but not okay for young boys to cry. And then we get a bunch of men who are unable to express their emotions and women who want them to express their emotions, but yet we were raised to not express our emotions, which is going to negatively impact our relationships now in the future. I've even had some women say, well, I want my man to be vulnerable and to show emotions and even potentially cry, but don't do it too much. So now we have a rule that we want you to show emotions. We want you to be vulnerable, even cry, but don't do it so much that it starts to grate on me or that I become uncomfortable because now I don't know how to support you in your emotional expression. It's very funny how that will be an unspoken rule. Like, I want you to show your emotions, but only so much. Well, where is this invisible line that you've just created? Is the likelihood that I won't step over it at some point is ridiculous. So emotional suppression, gender biases, unrealistic expectations, overprotection, inflexibility, lack of privacy, and authoritative parenting are bad ways that rules can show themselves within a family versus respecting our cultural heritage, conflict resolutions in healthy ways, spending quality time with one another, sharing responsibilities around the home, being adaptable and flexible, respecting each other's individuality, and having supportive communication are very positive, desirable ways that we can begin to set rules within the family. And then we get to society, who is affecting us in so many different ways, especially, again, now that we have these supercomputers and social media attached to our hips. There's so many more influences that used to not exist. Back in the day, you know, somebody living on a farm with their family and would have so few opportunities to be influenced by anyone outside their family unit. And now, at a very young age, you've got, you know, iPads being handed over to kids so they can watch cartoons or get on the internet or mess around with apps. And there's so many other ways that they can be influenced and manipulated by external sources outside of the familial unit. So we want to look for these desirable ways that society creates rules for us. The rule of law, I mean, the fact that there is sort of a punishment and an accountability keeps people from just randomly stealing cars and punching people in faces. The way that we have rules around taking care of our environment or educating one another, public health, equality, safety standards, accountability within our own public sphere, whether it be our politicians, which, the, you know, with the ability to vote and move these people at a local, state, and national level in and out of office based on how good they're governing, all the way up to the safety standards that we apply and the equality that we're seeking to achieve. It's so much has changed about society since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. And again, for thousands of years, we were farmers and we were just living in villages where everybody had a job. You were the blacksmith or you were the apothecary. And now we have so many different ways in which individuals can express themselves in society. It's not lost on me that the way we look back at the way our society, let's just focus on America for a moment, treated equality in the 70s, 60s, and 50s. Yes, it's radically shifted over the last 50 to 70 years. And to get angry with the way people behaved in the 70s based off of a 2024 visualization of how society has grown is unfair because what was okay back then is not necessarily okay now. Now, was it cool that they were doing some of the things? Blackface is coming to mind. Is it cool that people were doing that? No, it was not freaking cool that people were doing it. Hollywood made movies where people would do that. Was it cool? No. It was very, very disrespectful to the African-American population to have to see people doing that on stages and in theaters and things of that nature. Not at all desirable for a way for society to behave. But at the same time, that was okay then, not okay now. So again, not cool, but it was societally accepted as a form of behavior that is no longer accepted now. There's a lot of different things society has chosen is no longer acceptable in 2024 that were acceptable, 10 years ago. So let's just have a little bit of compassion and empathy for one another, make amends where we can about things, but let's not hold the past so tightly in our hands that we don't have space to grasp a hold of an amazing present, let alone for the future to land. it's very, very integral that we as a society let go of the shame and the guilt of the past, because holding on to that is just drinking poison and filling our bellies with this vitriol and hate that's not allowing for there to be an open space of communication in the present. And what's so interesting about going to meetings, especially in Hollywood, when I lived in Los Angeles, everybody, all walks of life would be in there. Talk about just acceptance of one another. You realize that addiction does not discriminate. So some bad ways that society can place rules upon us, whether it be censorship, mass surveillance, discriminatory laws, overcriminalization, corruption, economic inequality, environmental neglect, especially with us being from the addiction world, these discriminatory laws, these overcriminalizations, people having 20 years in prison because they got found with marijuana 3 different times. Like, you're freaking kidding me, right? Right. And it's, those are like rule-based good and bads for society. But we also have some that are more of on the behaviorist side, where we start to think about how we express our emotions, the volume in which we talk, the topics in which we talk about, the clothing that we wear, the music that we listen to. Where can that potentially show up, good and bad? Because if somebody's like, hey, you know what? In, you know, this neighborhood, we only listen to this kind of music. We only wear this color of clothing. We only do this particular thing. We don't do what those other people do. That can be very bad in the form of growing this kind of cooperative compassion towards one another. When we look at the way that rules can dictate how a society behaves, those will inevitably begin to affect the family, which will then show up as part of your own individual identity. Rules, whether they be beneficial or whether they're beneficial or detrimental, they will have unconscious effects on individuals and families and societies. And whether it's shaping your identity, influencing your decision making, affecting your emotional responses, determining your social interactions, driving habits and routines, influencing your perceptions of others, guiding your moral and ethical judgments, and that's just individually. When we start to look at the family way that these rules can show up, determining family dynamics, again, communication patterns shows up, your attachment styles, you know, is that going to be anxious? Is that going to be avoidant? Is that going to be disorganized? Guiding parenting practices, all of these things shape childhood development. They will, of course, influence family traditions and rituals. And when we start to think about these rules and all the ones that I've just rattled off, they will heavily determine your coping mechanisms, your ability to develop your unconscious healthy coping skills in response to stress and conflict. And if there is one theme that seems to continuously show up across all of these psychological theories that I'm studying for my master's class, coming up on an hour, my tongue is starting to tie, it is that a lack of healthy coping skills is what leads people down paths that they no longer serve, right? We had shitty coping skills come. My brain is running on empty now. We had really poor coping skills, and it was only a matter of time before somebody introduced us to something that was utilized to help us cope. Some people get introduced to education or a career trajectory that they just become so into that it just overtakes them, and they don't end up spending all their nights at a bar. Other people, they're introduced to alcohol and drugs at just the right time, and it seems like a really great way of coping with sadness or depression or a parental divorce or a death or something of that nature, and then it's like, boom shakalaka, here we go. Let's go down this path. A lack of healthy coping skills is, to me, very heavily rooted into all of these less desirable behaviors that we've fallen prey to. And then we can look at rules within society. It shapes cultural norms. It influences our social stratification, which is just this adherence to the societal rules, right? That can be beneficial if we have societal rules that promote equality and love and empathy, but not beneficial if it perpetuates inequalities. and a lack of opportunity for those people who really need it the most. When we think about people who have been in prison and how they come out, you know, once a felon, always a felon, we take away an opportunity for them to put their past behind them, which they've paid for. Whether you agreed with the judgment that was laid down and the time served or not, according to the legal system, they have paid their retribution. And now it's time to let them be able to release their past. I do not think it should be long-held belief at this point that once a felon, always a felon. That is not true. Let's allow people the grace to grow and change. Right, these rules can influence our legal system and enforcement. And whenever enough families get together, we can change society. Society rules will guide our economic practices, our political ideologies, our educational priorities. All of these things show up as rules. And now that I've rattled off probably 30 or 40 examples, you realize that these rules perpetuate down to our very core. They shape the identity. They influence our decision-making, our emotional responses, our social interactions, our habits, our routines, our perceptions of others, our moral and ethical judgments of ourselves and of others. You know, don't have to look too far to think, you know, back in the day, you know, we look at the Greeks and Romans, you know, a man having multiple partners or even homosexual relationships wasn't necessarily frowned upon. It was just societally accepted. Now we are now stepping into a place where homosexual relationships and people who choose to identify themselves differently than what would have been the status quo for, you know, millennia are now being socially accepted. And it's very interesting that there was a time where this was more accepted and then it became less accepted. And now we're shifting back to accepted. And it's all these morals and ethics that were, you know, a shifting of society. And I think it's really important that we realize that society is always shifting. And we want to be shifting in a way where people feel like they can be themselves. Now, don't be yourself so much that it holds somebody else down from being themselves. Right? We want to create space for everybody to be able to express themselves in a way, here's the caveat, that does not bring undue harm or pain onto somebody else. It's like you be you, but don't allow it to oppress or hurt someone else. And this is where I think that within the addiction recovery community, we can embrace this even more so than others because we know what it's like to be ostracized, to be the black sheep, to be kicked out of social circles, to be left behind on family gatherings, to even reject ourselves first thing in the morning when we look in the mirror. These rules shape us. I believe that everybody has space on this planet to succeed. Everyone should be accepted for who they are. I hold nothing against anybody based off of my background or the fact that I'm a T-SWAM, tall, straight, white, American male. Okay, that's how I was born. I had no control over being tall or straight or white or American or a male. Literally, all that shit was decided for me well before I even slid out of the womb. So teach his own. Be you. But be you in a way that empowers your strength and your love and your empathy to exude through your pores like sweat on a hot day. Be that amazing pillar within yourself, for yourself, within the family, within society. You are at a place where you have rung the bell. You've realized that being addicted was no longer serving you. You went from pre-contemplation to contemplation, right, to planning, to acting upon it, right? And now once you're acting upon it, it's just this dance with the lapse or the maintenance. And there can be a lot of different ways we lapse in our lives that are outside of alcohol and drugs. We can lapse in the way that we shut ourselves down emotionally. We can lapse in the way that we express ourselves, that we decide to take on a new challenge. Don't be the first one to reject yourself. Just don't be that person. I hear from a lot of people, well, I just don't know if I can take that on right now. I don't know if I have the time. I don't know if I have the ability. I don't trust my resources. I don't trust myself to see this through. You're making these decisions based off of past versions of yourself. I wasn't really sure what I was getting into when I stepped into this master's degree. I was just hell-bent on doing it. Have I figured out ways to move my schedule around so now that I have time for school and then I took on a restaurant job? And yes, did some aspects of my business no longer grow as quickly? Yes, I've had to shelf some ideas. Do I not have the time once in a while to sit down and continue doing, you know, the College Success Habits podcast, which I love? Absolutely. That had to get shelved for a little while. Did I have to let things get put on the back burner? Yes. But I never once thought I couldn't succeed in this schooling. I just knew that it was going to take a lot of effort. And where I was when I started this back in August versus where I am now going into March, it is phenomenal how much faster I can write an essay in well under 6 hours now. And a majority of that is just getting all the research materials in order and then reading through all of the research stuff to find the parts that I'm able to utilize within the essay. The writing of the essay, if I were to set a clock and be like, all I'm going to do is just time how long this thing takes me to write. 1,200 words, 1,500 words in less than an hour. But then it's the citations and the referencing and all that. And I had to learn that as a new habit. Now I sit down to do an essay and I'm amazed by how quickly I'm able to put this whole thing together, how many habits I've established. I had rules that told me from my 20s that I was not a good student. Well, anytime you decide to plow through an 8-ball and a bottle of Southern Comfort, you're probably going to be a shitty student if you're doing those two things while you're trying to study or write a paper. It just turns out that I wasn't a shitty student. I just had my priorities completely misaligned. I wanted to sit in my room and chain smoke cigarettes and do a bunch of drugs and drink while I did my schoolwork. Well, no wonder I got C's and D's. Now that I've shifted that, I've taken on new rules, that I am a good student, that I can manage my time, and I can still do all the things that I want to do. And maybe I'm just doing less of them, but I'm still able to accomplish these things. Rules are governing your life, and we've discussed so many of them in this show. Go back, listen through, write some down, really listen to what it is that we're talking about here. Because if there is a rule that you're holding yourself to from your past that's no longer serving you, it's time to change it. I don't talk about sex, or I don't talk about my emotions, or I don't talk about money. If that's what you're saying when it comes to you or your family, then you can change those things. Society, yeah, you know, I mean, you can still launch your own podcast, launch your own YouTube show, and talk about sex, money, or emotions all the freaking time. That's the beautiful thing, is now an individual can go and influence society through social media. So we really have an opportunity, like society, like human species has never had before, to get our message out there and allow it to be, you know, influenced through other people and be able to grow and learn. And just the power of stepping outside of these rules that are no longer serving us, it is, I can't even explain to you how important it is that you understand these and that you begin to break the ones that are holding you back, whether it's through your societal applications and how you go about, you know, your normal public life, whether it's within your family or whether it's within yourself. You have a choice each and every day on how you choose to behave. And whether it's biological, whether it's anatomy, whether it's behaviorist, psychological, whatever it might be, we understand that emotions is how we will generally behave right out the gate. And it's up to ourselves to create that space between the emotional surge of what's occurring and the rational mind being able to get in and being able to really fine-tune what it is that it's experiencing. Understand how these rules affect your life, and you will literally be able to change your life and shape-shift it, like, immediately. These are some of those things that we teach in the NLP class that does start at the end of March. JesseMogul.com/ask me. Go to the NLP coaching link and click on it and fill out the Google form. If you want to understand how these roles and rules and limiting beliefs and identity statements are literally manipulating and influencing and controlling your life at an unconscious level all around you, this class is for you. I'd love for you all to be in it. All it takes is for you to reach out. We'll get on a call. We'll discuss it. I have yet to have somebody who's gotten on a call with me say that it was not a good 30 minutes or so of conversation. If nothing else, we get to learn a little bit more about each other. I get to know who you are and why you're listening to the show. And that is beneficial beyond benefits. but it would be amazing to have you in the class as well. And that does start at the end of March. So by all means, fill out that form at jessemogul.com/ask me. Click on the NLP link and we'll learn more about how these unconscious rules dictate your life and how easy it is to break them and be free and be able to set up a whole new existence. It's all a choice. It's up to you to take the step. As always, my friends, inclusivity over exclusivity, the power of positive energy, release and flow. Every day is the best day of our lives when we wake up sober. Shout out to Sunshine and Robert and glow on. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.